Good morning, everyone. I'm Dion Schaffner, student in the ACC Creative Writing Department. In today's climate, so many can benefit from the history, teachings, and legacies of those who have come before us with their work in confronting police brutality, racism, and discrimination. I'm excited to be a part of the Celebrating Diverse Literary Voices, and I'm proud to introduce the members of today's panel. Let's begin with Peniel Joseph. He is the author of The Sword and the Shield, The Revolutionary Lives of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. He's here with us on today's panel. Dr. Joseph received a BA from State University of New York at Stony Brook and a PhD from Temple University. Dr. Joseph's career focus has been on what he describes as Black Power Studies, which encompasses interdisciplinary fields such as Africana Studies, Law and Society, Women's and Ethnic Studies, and Political Science. Through this focus, as a professor at Tufts, he founded their Center for the Study of Race and Democracy, and then joined the University of Texas as the founding director of their Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. He currently holds a joint professorship appointment at the LBJ School of Public Affairs as the Barbara Jordan Chair in Ethics and Political Values, and at the History Department in the College of Liberal Arts. Dr. Joseph is educating the minds of tomorrow's leaders while simultaneously engaging today's leaders through essays, op-eds, book reviews, and commentaries, garnering fellowships for his work, which continue to appear in prominent journals, newspapers, radio, and television. In addition to The Sword and the Shield, Dr. Joseph is also the author of Waiting Till the Midnight Hour, A Narrative History of Black Power in America, Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama, and Stokely, A Life. Please welcome Peniel Joseph.
Yay!
Next, we have Mr. Linder. Mr. Linder received his BA from Houston-Tillerson University in Industrial Relations and Personnel Management. He has long been a champion and community activist, this year celebrating 20 years as the Austin NAACP president. Congratulations, Mr. Linder. Mr. Linder's work towards ensuring the political, educational, social, and economic equality of rights of all persons and eliminating racial hatred and racial discrimination has been vast and impactful. From grassroots efforts for making our community safer to educating and encouraging our community to be involved and be the change we need. Mr. Linder has been recognized through many local and national awards, including the National NAACP Rupert Richardson Award, the National League of Cities Award, and Lifetime Achievement Awards from three organizations, KAZI, Precinct Number 1, and Austin Community College. Woo! And he's not done yet. Please welcome Mr. Nelson Linder. We also have today Reginald Owens. He is the retired chairman of the Department of Journalism at Louisiana Tech University. His interest in mass media began in his hometown at the Grambling High School student newspaper, where he served as editor, reporter, and advertising manager. As a student at Louisiana Tech in the 60s, he led multiple efforts to bring Black voices to campus, from creating the university's first African-American student organization, Soul Tech, to spurring on campus and in-community debates through his reporting in the school paper, to also bringing the first Black Greek organization to campus. Dr. Owens earned his bachelor's degree in journalism from Louisiana Tech and followed with a master's in advertising from University of Illinois and earned his PhD in journalism from the University of Texas. Both a practitioner and a teacher, his work has spanned roles of journalist, editor, curriculum developer, educator, director, trainer, and connector. He was the inaugural holder of the F.J. Taylor Endowed Chair of Journalism at Louisiana Tech, adjunct professor at the Freedom Forum Diversity Institute at Vanderbilt, and has taught and lectured at several colleges and universities, including Grambling, Texas Southern, Houston-Tillotson, Austin Community College, and the University of Texas. Dr. Owens is currently on the boards of directors for the Dow Jones News Fund, the Shreveport Journalism Foundation, the Greater Grambling Chamber of Commerce, and the Eddie G. Robinson Museum Commission. Please welcome Reginald Owens. And we have Brandon Winford. Brandon Winford is an assistant professor of history at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. He is a historian on the late 19th and 20th century United States and the African-American experience, and his research focuses on the relationship between civil rights and capitalism. Dr. Winford received his BA and MA in history from North Carolina Central University and his PhD in history from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Dr. Winford is the co-founder of the Fleming Morrow Endowment in African American History, named in honor of two pioneer Black professors in the UTK College of Arts and Sciences and Department of History. This endowment provides funding for an annual lecture and student prizes in the fields of civil rights and military history. Dr. Winford is the recipient of the 2019 Junior Diversity Leadership Award from the UTK College of Arts and Sciences and 2020 Hardy Liston's Junior Symbol of Hope Award. He is the author of the book, John Irving Wheeler, Black Banking and the Economic Struggle for Civil Rights. The book combines Black business and civil rights history to explain how economic concerns shape the goals and objectives of the Black freedom struggle. It received one of the 2020 Lillian Smith Book Awards. Dr. Winford is currently working on his second book manuscript, provisionally titled A History of Black Banking in the America South Since 1865. It will provide a comprehensive social, political, and economic history of Black banks in the region with rich details about the men and women bankers, board members, managers, employees, customers, examiners, and politicians responsible for their existence. Good luck with your next book, and welcome to the panel, Brandon Winford.
Thank you very much, Dion. So just a couple of housekeeping things. One, we're going to ask all questions will come through the chat room. Charlotte Gullick with Austin Community College will be curating those questions and asking those questions once we get to the audience Q&A part. The first part of the event today will be the discussion of the books written by Dr. Joseph and Dr. Winford. And then after about 20, 25 minutes discussion, we'll open it up for a Q&A from the audience. And then after that, then the second part, we will have a discussion with Dr. Owens and Nelson Linder about their involvement as activists. And then we'll open it up for Q&A for them. And then we plan to spend about the final 30 minutes with an interactive discussion, because one of the things I wanted to do with this event was take both a historical look. We have iconic leaders with Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, based on the dual biography that Dr. Joseph wrote. Then we have another great leader, civil rights leader from North Carolina that, frankly, I had never heard of until Dr. Winford wrote the book, John Hervey Wheeler, another great leader. One of the things we want to make sure as we move forward historically is not only recognize the great contributions of our iconic leaders, but there are also so many other leaders who have had an incredible impact, like Ella Baker, for example, serving as chief operating officer for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, who don't get the same recognition as the iconic people like John Hervey Wheeler. So if I haven't muted you, please make sure that you mute your microphones and you stop your video in terms of that, because what we want to do, we do plan to make this available on a YouTube channel as a video. So I'm going to go ahead and get started. Dr. Joseph and Dr. Winford, the same way we got started yesterday when you were talking to the students that are part of the African American Harvest Youth Foundation. And so starting with you, Dr. Joseph, I'd like you to talk about how you first fell in love with history and got to know Martin Luther King and Malcolm X.
I'm having my soon-to-be five-year-old let her know that daddy's doing something. Thank you, Hopeton, for setting this up. And we had a great time with the students yesterday, and really for all that you've done in terms of bringing this Black literary historical activist tradition to Austin for decades. And for really all the folks who are on the panel, thank you so much for your leadership and your service. I'm from New York City. I grew up, born and raised in Brooklyn and Queens, New York. And my mother is now retired, but she was a hospital worker, 1199 SEIU. So I started being politicized very, very early. So I was on my first picket line. I'm 47 now, over 40 years ago. So I grew up in a very activist household. My parents are Haitian immigrants. My mom is a Haitian Pan-African historian. She's a feminist who told me about the Black women who were leaders in the Haitian Revolution alongside of Toussaint Louverture and Jean-Jacques Dessalines. So that was the household we grew up in. And that really made me deeply interested in history. You know, even before Eyes on the Prize came out in junior high school, my mom gave me and my older brother, who's an ER doctor now, she gave us C.L.R. James's The Black Jacobins to read when we were in elementary school. And we actually read that. So I was reading The Black Jacobins when I was 9 and 10 years old. And she would explain aspects of it that you couldn't, but she was, I mean, it was an extraordinary childhood. So I knew, we knew we were Black. There was no epiphany. We knew we were both Haitian and Black American and African. We knew who our political adversaries were. I remember being 8 years old when Ronald Reagan won his election to the presidency, and my mother telling me that Reagan was an enemy of Black people and giving me the history of what Reagan had done to the Black Panthers. This was a person who hated us, who hated Black women, who called us welfare queens in the 1976 primary campaign. She told us all this, and we were like, okay, so we get it. You know, this person's not our friend and ally. And so that got me interested in history. And then finally, I'll say, in the 1980s in New York City, I was on marches, demonstrations against police brutality before the Black Lives Matter movement. Police in New York had murdered Eleanor Bumpus, a grandmother. White moms had murdered Michael Griffith in Howard Beach my freshman year in 1986. Later on, it's Yusef Hawkins, Sean Bell, Amadou Diallo, a bunch of Black women and men were constantly getting murdered by the NYPD. And that made us all think about the movement for Black power, the movement for civil rights that had always tried to resist these forces. And people like Sonny Carson in New York City were there. There were so many different, G2 Weyusi of the East was there. So we marched with so many different leaders, Black women and Black men who were from the 1950s and 60s, who were continuing the struggle in the 80s and 90s. And that got me deeper into the history and falling in love with the history.
So Brandon, how did you fall in love with history?
Good morning, everybody. I think it's still morning there. I'm in the East Coast. Thanks again for inviting me and having me. I'm glad to be here. I really got interested in history at a young age, reading during Black History Month newspaper inserts in the local newspaper, and just really being fascinated by those images and those stories. When I was a child, I had a local or neighborhood high school student get me and my brothers and some cousins together for a Black History Month club to teach us Black history. That only lasted for like a day because everybody else wanted to go out and play. But really, my dad, my mom, my parents, working class, cotton textile mill workers, my dad introduced my brothers and I to, you know, films like Spike Lee's Malcolm X. I was really fascinated by those images. But in sixth grade, I had an African-American English teacher, Mrs. Hooper, who I was introduced to, and had the first opportunity to read the autobiography of Malcolm X for the first time. So I was really captivated by that story. That was the year when I was shown Eyes on the Prize and a number of other instances throughout my life with my dad and my mom that happened related to race in our community sort of brought about a sort of consciousness and a little sort of curiosity about African Americans and their place in history in terms of the Black experience. And in college, I was really exposed to history in a way that I had never been exposed to history in terms of the professors at North Carolina Central really presenting history and arguments and kind of letting the students decide for themselves how to really sort of come up with their own conclusions about history. So that's kind of how I really sort of came into history. I was always interested in it, but in college was really sort of exposed to being able to sort of understand it on a deeper level and began to think about writing and interpreting history. So that's a little bit of how I came into history.
Dr. Joseph, when with your dual biography, you sort of bridged the gap in terms of the public who generally like to see Malcolm X and Martin Luther King at opposite ends of the polls, sort of like W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington. They're portrayed as these mortal enemies, where the reality is that W.E.B. Du Bois sent a note to Booker T. Washington when he made the Atlanta Compromise speech, congratulated him on it. And Booker T. Washington actually tried to hire W.E.B. Du Bois several times. So talk a little bit about sort of the misconceptions of the philosophies of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and how much closer they actually are.
Yeah, the misconceptions are that Dr. King is a man of peace and nonviolence, and Malcolm is self-defense and by any means necessary, and that in a way they set up Malcolm as Dr. King's evil twin who wrecks the civil rights movement. The reality is that they're both political revolutionaries. Malcolm is trying to achieve radical Black dignity, which he defines as really an end to white supremacy, both in the United States, but globally. And that's gonna be a mixture of both anti-racism, anti-colonialism, but really Black political self-determination. So Malcolm's a Black power activist, even during the civil rights movement. And then King is talking about radical Black citizenship, both the end of racial and economic oppression, but the visible appearance of justice, which he says is guaranteed income, housing, desegregation. And so when you look at them, they really are serving as each other's alter ego. So the sword and the shield, the metaphor is that we usually think of Malcolm as the sword and King as the shield, but they really are both. And they come to see that you need radical Black dignity and radical Black citizenship.
Now, Dr. Winford, when we look at John Hervey Wheeler, one of the reasons I was attracted to the book was the fact that we had a Black banker who was also a lawyer and a civil rights activist all at the same time, and who also was supportive of the student movement in North Carolina. So sort of dispels the misconception of Black business people as not supportive of the civil rights movement or very hesitant. And he was a radical supporter of the civil rights movement.
Definitely ahead of his time in many ways. And we can look at John Hervey Wheeler, who's born in 1908, Morehouse College graduate in 1929. So by the 1930s and 1940s, he is working in Durham for the Mechanics and Farmers Bank. There was already a sort of what I like to call a training ground in Black business activism in Durham. So he's coming into a context where business leaders are already working and operating in the community on various issues. And so he's part of a generation during that particular period in the decades before we get to the 1950s and 1960s who sort of provide this sort of groundwork. But he's also, again, ahead of his time and oftentimes seen as radical in so many ways. And he's functioning and operating as this Black business activist and is partly concerned or generally concerned with Black's economic rights in terms of citizenship and civil rights. He looks at economics and economic empowerment of African Americans as a pathway. So full citizenship as a pathway to Black economic empowerment, ultimately because of what it can contribute to this idea of New South prosperity, right? So he's interested in civil rights and comes at civil rights as a Black businessman because of economic concerns. And so he's a banker, was president of one of the largest owned Black banks in the country. And during the 1940s, he begins a legal effort under the guise of the NAACP's legal strategy to attack educational equality in Durham, North Carolina, a case that he won in 1950 to bring about school equalization in North Carolina. He was also a lawyer for the first three Black undergraduates at University of North Carolina. He was a strong advocate of fair housing and equal housing for African-Americans, equal employment opportunities for African-Americans. He held several presidential appointments during both the Kennedy and Johnson administration during the 1960s. And so He's someone, again, who is representative of and challenges really this myth that African-American business people were either not supportive or limited in their support of citizenship. John Wheeler understood ultimately that the gains in civil rights had benefits for his bank, for Black business, and also Black institutions, because he believed that if given an opportunity, his bank could compete in the marketplace with other banks of comparable size. So he's come at civil rights as an African-American, but he's also thinking about Black institutions and in particular Black capitalism and its survival during this particular period. So he's a very interesting guy in the fact that he kind of operates sort of behind the scenes in some ways, but he's very much out public when it comes to politics, when it comes to the legal strategy, and things of that nature.
So Dr. Joseph, when you look at the movement today, and when I look at the movement today, it's the largest movement of my adult lifehood. So I was born in 1960, but I was a young man when the civil rights movement was going on. How would you look at today's movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, the racial justice movement of today, within the context of what you've learned from studying the lives of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr.?
Yeah, I would say it's a continuation. It's an amplification. I'd say that when we think about Black Lives Matter, both in 2013, 14, 15, and now 2.0, which in this iteration, largest political mobilization in American history for really anything. So this is for racial justice, Black dignity, and Black citizenship. So I'd say that they fuse aspects of civil rights and Black power. So they fuse aspects of the Black Power movement's structural criticism and bold assault against white supremacy with aspects of the civil rights movement's nonviolent civil disobedience and large public demonstrations to try to shift the public tenor on issues of racial justice. So there they owe a legacy, a debt to not just Malcolm and Martin, but like you were saying, Hope, did Ella Baker, the founder of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Fannie Lou Hamer. They owe a debt to James Baldwin, Audre Lorde. I think what's so interesting about this movement and how it connects to past movements is the place Black women have in this movement in a very central way. They've always been central to movements, but not as visible as men, because of patriarchy, because of sexism. And then gay and lesbian and trans Black folks have been around too, but certainly been marginalized within the community. So I think the thing that Black Lives Matter has done really brilliantly is connect both very specific policy strategies like reparations, defund the police, prison abolition, to this idea of centering the least of these amongst ourselves within the Black community. And again, in that sense, it's very similar to Dr. King and Malcolm, because Malcolm wanted to center Black prisoners and those who are incarcerated and Black women in a certain way from a certain perspective. But King wanted to really center the poor and say the poor folks in Marks, Mississippi, and in places like Louisiana, Alabama, South Carolina, but also in ghettos in the West Coast and the East Coast were the people we should be most concerned about. So I think they've amplified the legacies of the Black freedom struggle. They've really shown the world now what intersectional justice means. You know, we all live our identities through race, class, gender, sexuality, income, you know, geography. And the COVID-19 pandemic shows that you can have a plague that affects all of us, but differently. Those of us who are on this call are people who've got the technology and we've been able to continue to work and pay rent and have mortgages and have our kids safe, right? Even if people might have people they know who got COVID-19, maybe even loved ones who lost their lives, but you're safe. And so not everyone has the relative privilege we have. This is when we try to explain to white people what white privilege is. Right now, we all have privilege. It's not white privilege, but we have some kind of economic privilege where we're not forced to go back to work. Those of us who are at universities have been Zooming. They've still been direct depositing our checks, Our health care is still there. Our homes are still intact, right? So what Black Lives Matter has said, and it's really been a lesson to Black people, to all of us, is what if we center what the Bible calls, and Dr. King said, the least of these, right? We all have read, or hopefully, our Old Testament and our New Testament. And the Bible makes the claim that, you know, the last shall be first. Those who've been most marginalized are the ones who are in line to enter the kingdom of heaven. And so when we think about the social gospel, and Dr. King was a big believer in the social gospel connects biblical themes and testaments to the world we live in now, today, and says we need to use our religious faith to transform inequality in the here and now. And so when we think about BLM, especially 2.0, this has been beautiful. And I think we have to connect what's going on now to what Dr. King called the beloved community and what Malcolm X said was a human rights movement, because they wanted to obliterate and end all levels of injustice. But in their times, there was sexism, misogyny, patriarchy, homophobia, that at times the community, Black communities, were marginalizing our own people. Because Black people who are gay, who are lesbian, they're our people. These are our sons and daughters, no matter what anybody thinks. So you don't throw out your family. I got my daughter upstairs. I wouldn't leave my daughter for anything in the world, no matter what she says she is. You know what I mean? I'm going to embrace. So we've learned to embrace the full Black family, which I think is really, really awesome. And the people who've been at the center of this are Black, queer, identified feminists who've really made us look at our own humanity and say, we can't leave anybody behind. We're trying to have this Black human rights movement, and we can't say we don't like that person in the corner because of A, B, C, or D. And I think that's been really revolutionary. And the only way we can build that beloved community is if we don't say we're going to leave people behind because of our own internal prejudices.
So Dr. Winford, talk a bit about John Hervey Wheeler, the iteration or the development of the movement in Durham, North Carolina, because as Dr. Joseph said, it starts off initially as a fight against the injustice, the police brutality, and it sort of really develops far beyond that. There is a general call for equity, a general look at inequities across the board, not just in the criminal justice system. So talk a little bit about how John Hervey Wheeler also at the same time started off specifically in a smaller area and sort of grew his involvement with the movement.
One of the things I really appreciate about John Hervey Wheeler's story was, here's someone who was born of economic means. His father was an executive with the North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company, one of the largest Black-owned insurance companies in the United States. He was born in North Carolina. He grew up in Atlanta, Georgia. So he came of age during Jim Crow segregation. One of the things he often said was that he kind of started off life even economically. And so in many ways, he felt like he was always a part of American society, you know, even though he had certain kinds of limitations. And so as a businessman coming of age and working, he could have easily not participated in the struggle for civil rights. And so the thing I learned about his story was that he was someone that understood his own positioning, but also made it a point to see that African-Americans, in terms of the masses, had greater access to all kinds of civil rights issues, whether we're talking about employment, education, housing, so forth. And so here we see him really navigating this world, this society, from that particular standpoint. And so in Durham, one of the civil rights organizations that emerges during the 1930s is that it was called the Durham Committee on the Negro, Durham Committee on Negro Affairs. And it was established as a broad coalition across class and across professional and other kinds of occupational sectors. And it was supposed to bring about Black equality within the confines of education, housing, religion. It had a legal redress committee, right? One of the defining issues that brought African Americans together in Durham during this particular time was police brutality, right? There was an African American man who was murdered by the police. His name was, I think John McNeil is his name. He was murdered by the police in the late 1930s. And the Durham Committee used it as a rallying cry to bring about a cohesive and a unified collective positioning of African-Americans. And John Wheeler said that that was one of the most important issues that went about defining and crystallizing the Durham Committee's position during this particular period. And so we look at John Hervey Wheeler, sort of another one of his favorite refrains was, the battle for freedom begins every morning. If we think about what that means, is that he understood that the fight for citizenship and civil rights was something that, yes, if you attack certain issues and solve those problems, you got to get up the next day and to continue to fight for other kinds of issues. And I think that's important for us to understand in this contemporary moment, and for us to understand we're continuously grappling with American citizenship, is that American citizenship for a lot of people has always been tenuous or temporary. And I think the guarantees of citizenship have also in many ways been temporary for a lot of people. And I think as much as we're trying to sort of obtain a particular designation in terms of we have all of our rights now, I don't think in many ways, I think that's not necessarily possible. In other words, I think we're going to continuously have to fight and redefine what our citizenship rights are going to be. And we have to continuously be on guard about protecting those citizenship rights. And so I think we're going to continuously have or continuously need to participate in obtaining citizenship and fighting for citizenship. And so when we think about John Wheeler, we can think about him from within that particular context. I also want to point out that as we're linking the civil rights movement of earlier generations to today, I think it's also important for us to go back. We're talking about Malcolm X, we're talking about Martin Luther King, Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker. And student activism is really important, and student leadership and youth leadership is very important. And we have to understand that in those contexts, the youth were always trying to not necessarily work within an established framework, but they were always trying to really literally tear it down to begin anew. And I think that's what we're seeing now. We're seeing folks who are not compromising with the intersectionalities of everyone. And so in some ways I've been a bit pessimistic about this moment, but I think, you know, in thinking about sort of the Black experience, we know that there is another side to this that we're going to come out of. And so I think that's really important for us to sort of keep in mind we're having this conversation.
I'm going to ask anybody who has any questions, if you could go ahead and put those questions into the chat. Charlotte Gullick will be curating those questions. We're going to start asking questions from the audience in about 7 or 8 minutes here. But for the last question I have for both of you, starting with you, Dr. Joseph, is why do you think it's important for the leaders of today to know the history of leaders and movements of the past, like the work that Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. did?
Yeah, I think it's critically important because right now everybody's having this discussion of anti-racism. But as we all know, Black scholars and activists, Black history is anti-racism. And so the only way you can understand how to be an anti-racist, and that's a new book by one of my mentees, actually, a young man, Ibram X. Kendi, who I've now as a colleague, and I love Ibram, but I've known him since he was in graduate school at Temple, my alma mater. Anti-racism is great, but the leading innovators of that are the Ida B. Wellses and the Frederick Douglasses and Anna Julia Cooper and these Black women and men who were leading activists trying to transform policy, politics, legislation, culture, the church, popular culture as well. So when you think about Malcolm and Martin, they're really amongst our greatest champions of anti-racism and Black dignity and Black citizenship ever. Malcolm taught Negroes how to be Black. You know, there's certainly Marcus Garvey is part of this, Amy Jacques Garvey, but Malcolm, when people are calling themselves now African-American and African and Black people, people have to understand when you used to call each other. We used to call each other black in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, even into the 70s. People were having fights and fist fights when you called somebody black because it was considered something very, very negative. We didn't want to be connected with Africa, except those of us who are really racially conscious. So, you know, that Malcolm is the innovator of that black power movement for black self-determination. There's going to be no Stokely Carmichael without Malcolm, no Angela Davis, no Black Lives Matter movement without a Malcolm X. And in a way, Black Lives Matter is really the latest iteration of calling for black power. You know, just like black power was criticized, Black Lives Matter was criticized as well. People saying all lives matter and blue lives matter and things like that. And then certainly with Dr. King, we need a really to wrap our heads around because they only give us one side of King's legacy. They give us the March on Washington speech. They don't let us understand. King would have been for every single thing that the Black Lives Matter movement is after today. And so King would have been for defunding the police. King was a revolutionary who spoke out against the war in Vietnam. He spoke out for a peace movement. So King uses nonviolence to talk about reparations, to talk about redeeming the soul of America. And King didn't just believe in black sacrifice. He said white people were going to have to sacrifice their privilege, their power to build the beloved community. So you've got to know about both of these leaders to understand where we are today. And they also give us insights into their successes, but also their shortcomings, give us insights into where we should be moving into the 21st century. So you need to know them both. Malcolm and Martin are the two critical pieces to understand the puzzle that we're in.
So Dr. Winford, same question for you specifically. What can they learn from knowing the history of John Hervey Wheeler and the work he did in Durham, North Carolina, and really across the country?
So there are a number of things. When you look at someone like John Hervey Wheeler, he is, in many ways, he's ahead of his time, but he's also representative of the traditional black leadership. And we know that the traditional black leadership in all its forms had certain kinds of strategies that it put forward, right? We can talk about the legal strategy, we can talk about the direct action strategy. And John Wheeler thought that those strategies were important, but he also felt like the most difficult piece of or the most difficult obstacle for African Americans to get through was institutional forms of racism, right? He felt like that next step, how do you implement all of the gains of civil rights, was going to be the most difficult challenge for us. And I think if we look at his example and his support of student activists and working behind the scenes, we find that there are some very important strategies in support of that he was very much a part of. One of the things about him also is, and this could be a kind of criticism, was that in many ways he was beholden to institutions and organizations. In other words, his positioning was to work through organizations like the Durham Committee, the NAACP, other organizations to achieve and obtain rights for African Americans, to work through organized pressure, politics. He felt was extremely important. And so I think what's important for in terms of that example and how it relates to our contemporary moment is John Wheeler was also involved in public policy, right? It was one thing to get people access to lunch counters. It was one thing to get people even access and integration in terms of the workplace. But what kind of policies were going to be brought forward and what kind of policies were going to be put in place in order for civil rights activists and organizations to try to bring about some kind of implementation of civil rights legislation and so forth. And so I think thinking about public policy, but also thinking about there are all kinds of ways and alternative strategies that we can bring to the table to bring about change. And I think it's important for every leader to recognize their strengths and weaknesses and recognize that not everyone is going to play the same role. Not everyone can play the same role. And so I think it's about also sort of tapping into one's individual leadership capabilities and understanding their strengths and where they can fit in. And John Wheeler understood his role, right? He didn't try to become a grassroots organizer in the same way that those student demonstrators in on January 8, 1960 in Durham, North Carolina, began to take part in. But there are moments when he went on the picket line to make his support for those activists very clear. And I think that's a lesson for our leaders in more established organizations, right? To make sure that those activists who are coming behind us understand where we have a sense of where we stand in support of them. And that support also means funding. We think about John Wheeler, he's a banker. So he provided all kinds of funding support to student activists and other organizations during this particular period. He was also an anti-poverty activist, right? And so there are all kinds of ways in which we can learn from those examples and really learning from the ways in which he worked with Black Power activists, people like Howard Fuller, who started Malcolm X Liberation in North Carolina. He worked with mothers and women who were leaders in their housing project associations. And so he worked from that particular framework, right? And also he was part of the Black middle class. And so there are all kinds of criticism and ways in which he was not going to give up that positioning in society. But I think we can pull back some of those layers on these particular individuals through understanding their overall civil rights goals and objectives and how they best saw their own roles within society.
All right, at this point, I'm going to ask if there are any other questions to please relay them through the chat. I'm going to ask Charlotte to go ahead and unmute herself and show her video. And to I think we have one remark there, Charlotte, that we can share with the panelists here.
Yeah, Mark Cunningham has said a great point here, especially for non-Black people. We have to try and find what our best and most effective contribution will be. So I don't know if folks want to comment on that further.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point. I got my little daughter in there. I think that's a great point. You have to get in where you fit in. So not everyone's going to be a day-to-day organizer. So somebody like Stokely Carmichael, people like Ruby Doris Smith Robinson, people like Diane Nash, these were folks who were getting arrested and going to prison and doing the day-to-day work. And people like Dr. King were mobilizers, and people like John Wheeler were people who were using their institutional knowledge and institutional base to help these movements. So really, it's like wherever you are, you can make a difference. And just because somebody's not out in the streets protesting doesn't necessarily mean that they're not an ally. So that's very, very important to remember.
So we have a question for Dr. Joseph. You mentioned learning from both the successes and shortcomings of Malcolm X and MLK. What specific shortcomings do you find most notable or teachable?
Well, before you answer that question, Dr. Joseph, I think Dr. Winfrey wanted to also respond to the previous comment.
I apologize.
No problem.
I will only add that it's important to recognize who has already been doing the work and what efforts they've already put into this, and being really sort of cognizant of that and being willing to support those efforts already. We don't, you know, and I'm talking from an institutional perspective with, you know, thinking about my own university, there's a way in which our institutions can come in and support these new initiatives and efforts while marginalizing those ones that have already been sort of put forth. And so I think there's a sense of urgency to do new things and all those and everything. But it's important to sort of recognize what's already being done and around you. And you can fit in, whether it's financial support, whether it's really going to sort of those entities and really asking, you know, how can I support? How can I be a part? And also it's important to recognize that we've been asked to do a lot more of this work. And so it's important to sort of find a balance between, you know, you wanting Black folks to lead and be a part of efforts, but there's a lot of stuff that we're already doing, right? And so I think those things are important in my estimation about where some of our allies can fit in.
Okay, Dr. Joseph. the previous question that was asked of you.
And Charlotte, what was the question again?
So it's basically that you talked about successes and shortcomings of Malcolm X and MLK. So what specific shortcomings do you find most notable or most teachable?
Yeah, okay, so there's a bunch. I mean, I think that one, when you think about Malcolm, the call for self-defense is understandable and it's a constitutional right. But at times there was a feeling that there could be some kind of black political revolution through armed rebellion that was going to be very similar to what happened in Cuba and what was happening in Africa. And I think that, you know, that was a misreading of the situation. And then at the same time, King's voting rights, civil rights, and these policy transformations, there was not a realization that there was going to be limits to these changes and transformations in a racist society. So I think both of them at times made certain mistakes vis-a-vis having too much faith in certain kinds of institutions, you know? And one of the things I think that the situation we're in now shows you is that you can't rely on a single strategy. It can't be an insider strategy or just an outsider strategy. You need both. The protests that we're seeing and all the changes that we've seen with monuments and memorials and Confederate flags and different investments and donations show you the power and the impact of mobilization, which is what King and Malcolm both saw. But then there are also limits because mobilization can't necessarily just transform institutions from top to bottom, longstanding institutions. And that's what needs to be transformed if you're talking about political revolution.
Dr. Winford, did you want to comment on that at all?
No.
Okay. All right.
I will actually, because I did have a thought. So when we think about John Wheeler, I mentioned, you know, his shortcomings in terms of being in many ways beholden to established institutions and organizations. That was how he sought to work toward certain kinds of goals. I think also a larger limitation or shortcoming is this idea that the goals and objectives of civil rights were also the goals and objectives of black capitalism and black business. And I think when one of the biggest sort of examples of that is John Wheeler's support of and championing of urban renewal in Durham, right? He was head of a civil rights organization with a significant political block, and he was one of the people, and the Durham Committee was one of the organizations that got African-Americans to support urban renewal. Now, thinking about his record on civil rights, these organizations, they studied these particular issues, so they were not naive in terms of the ultimate outcomes of something like urban renewal, but in some ways, they kind of trusted the larger sort of plan and the outcomes of urban renewal in terms of revitalizing black communities, bringing in economic development in areas that were deemed blighted areas. And so in terms of those shortcomings, we can sort of think about the limitations of black business and leadership when it comes to an example like urban renewal.
Thank you. So there's a comment and then there's a conversation happening in the chat box, but I'm going to look for the questions specifically. Travis says, all people need to learn and understand black history, which is part of American history. Until that happens, black people will continue to be devalued. Then Marcus McWhorter, who is chair of the drama department at ACC, who probably didn't want me to say that, he's asking the question, I'm curious about capitalism in the conversation of black human rights. On the one hand, there is the idea that economic security, generational wealth, home ownership, and financial literacy serves as a foundation for or a safeguard of full citizenship. On the other hand, there have been arguments that capitalism is intimately wed to colonialism, exploitation, and white supremacy. In studying the history of black human rights, how have its proponents view the role of capitalism in the context of the movement?
I'll say very quickly, it depends on their ideological perspective. I mean, critics and radicals and revolutionaries a lot of times have a critique of capitalism, and talk about what Cedric Robinson called racial capitalism. And what by racial capitalism, we mean this idea that capitalism in the United States is historically unequal and based on the super exploitation of Black people. And it sets up a supply chain of power and privilege for whites and misery and grief for Black people. So from that perspective, they would push back against John Wheeler. They would push back against any Black proponent of even a progressive kind of Black capitalism, because they're gonna say inherently, this system is not only corrupt, but the system that has produced all this white wealth historically is based on Black dehumanization, right? So in that perspective, all the white suburbs are based on Black ghettos. All the Black people in prison, they provide a supply chain of power and privilege to whites, from correctional officers to judges to presidents of the United States, to leaders in Silicon Valley and Fortune 500 companies globally, right? So from that perspective, there's nothing redeemable about it. Another perspective says we have to be in on that game too. And you'll find some Black power activists like a Floyd McKissick, who tries to get money from Richard Nixon and build Soul City in North Carolina. But guess what? The money doesn't come from Nixon. So Floyd McKissick ends up losing all of his principles and his morals for a Soul City that never happens. Howard Fuller changes too. Howard Fuller goes from being a Marxist-Leninist to somebody who's pro-charter schools, Owusu Sadokai, until the times change. So basically, when we think about capitalism, has capitalism ever worked for the majority of Black people? No. But has capitalism worked for the Oprah Winfreys, the Jay-Z's, Barack Obama? Yes, it has. So from that perspective, there are people who are saying, as long as the system is this neoliberal capitalist system, we should be playing that game. But unfortunately, most African Americans have never gotten access to capital. And the racial capitalist perspective says, nor will they, because the entire system is predicated on making sure that those communities are under-resourced and disinvested from, so that white communities can have investment and have access to a racial caste system. That means even the poorest white person is gonna have more access to financial capital, better treatment by the criminal justice system, live in safer communities than Black people.
And I would add that, and John Wheeler was actually on the board of Soul City, and worked as a lawyer, worked with Floyd McKissick on so many civil rights issues. And Floyd McKissick, if you listen to him, his interviews and read some of his writings, he looked at something like Soul City and economic empowerment and as an important goal when we think of civil rights, but also he pointed to the example of the Marshall Plan, right? He envisioned something like the Marshall Plan, right? And by late 1960s, early 1970s, Nixon, of course, is in many ways hijacking the Black power, Black economic power in the form of Black capitalism. To bring it back to John Herbert Wheeler and sort of this connection between civil rights and more broadly, this fight for global rights, John Wheeler domestically is interesting because he was a civil rights activist. Black business activists domestically argued that African Americans needed all their civil rights and full citizenship simultaneously. But it's interesting when we take those concerns abroad. I'm working on an article now about African-American business abroad. John Wheeler and other Black business people from North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company on down, they worked with the State Department internationally. They represented the United States in many ways in a diplomatic capacity internationally. And if you look at some of their correspondence with people like President Johnson and so forth, they are upholding the U.S.'s Cold War policies, right? When they're talking with African nationalists who come to Durham, North Carolina, and in visits set up by the State Department to basically look at democracy in action for African Americans. They're representative of what could be possible, right? And that these African nationalists and other others who are other newly independent African countries and in other places around the world. Here is an example of the most oppressed group in our country. They're succeeding. And these business people, in many ways, were a part of shaping the U.S.'s relationship with those newly independent African nations. And I think it's a really interesting conversation that domestically civil rights is being championed really hard. Abroad, they're falling under the Cold War foreign policy. And there are a lot of reasons as to why that is. John Wheeler goes to South Africa in 1959, but he refuses to go on a second-class citizenship basis. When he comes back, he writes an article called Apartheid Implemented or Education Implemented by Apartheid in South Africa. So he's critical of apartheid from that particular perspective. But he's also criticized by his bank customers in the late 1960s because he continues to go back to South Africa as part of this U.S.-South Africa Leadership Exchange Program. And so they question, you know, particularly during the late 1960s when the civil rights movement is, or civil rights leaders like John Wheeler, I should say, are confronting and being confronted by Black power activists. And they're being questioned about where their commitments lie, right? And so I think that's really sort of important for us to sort of think about in terms of how those leaders sort of view their position as capitalists and also thinking about their civil rights and human rights concerns. We could take someone like Leon Sullivan, who joins the board of Ford in the early 1970s. He's part of the first group of African Americans to join Fortune 500 boards. As part of being on the board, he does some things to get Ford and other corporations to rethink their policies in South Africa. And so there's some things that also happen from the perspective of Black business people that go to support global human rights. And it's something for us to really sort of think about.
All right. Well, we're just about out of time. We do have some other questions in the chat. Hopefully, if we have time at the end, we'll come back to those questions. Dr. Winford, Dr. Joseph, thank you very much for participating in this panel discussion. Of course, we want you to stay around because when we get toward the end, after talking with Nelson Linder and Dr. Owens, we hope to get you involved in a very open discussion. And as historians, I'm hoping you'll have a lot of questions for the retired journalism professor and the leader of the Austin NAACP. So
I'm going to try to stay on, but I've got my little daughter here. So
we want her to be part of this. We want her involved.
I have to go spend some time with her.
So
I'll connect with you.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Dr. Winford, thank you so much. You're great. I'm so excited about reading the book.
So I do want to make the comment that there were questions about William Monroe Trotter, comments about William Monroe Trotter, W.E.B. Du Bois, and Booker T. Washington. And I think Dr. Joseph would have been great to have Dr. John Sibley Butler and Dr. Juliet E.K. Walker going, having a serious discussion about Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois.
Yeah, and Kerry Greenridge has the great new biography, Black Radical, about William Monroe Trotter. That's really a brilliant book that I've read. So Kerry Greenridge has a awesome, and William Monroe Trotter is one of the key late 19th, early 20th century, the Boston Guardian, who's a critic of W.E.B. Du Bois, a critic to the left of Du Bois, a critic of Booker T. Washington, somebody who was uncompromising in wanting Black dignity and citizenship and using the press to get there.
And just for those who may not know, both Dr. Walker and Dr. Butler are professors at the University of Texas at Austin, and both have written books about Black business. Dr. Walker wrote a book on the history of Black business in America. Dr. Walker, Black Self-Help and Employment, I believe, was the name of his book. And for those of you who may know Dr. Butler, he is a huge fan of Booker T. Washington, and Dr. Walker is a huge fan of W.E.B. Du Bois. But now I'm going to pivot, and I'm going to ask Nelson Linder and Reginald Owens to unmute yourselves, and we'll go on to the next part of our discussion here. I'm asking both of you to unmute. Let's see. So we're working on Reginald. Let's see. Nelson Linder. Or we have Reginald Owens here. Let's see. There we go. We're going to ask, if available, Nelson to go ahead and start his video. Okay, are you there, Nelson? There we go. Excellent, excellent. So what was most exciting to me about this event was not just making it about the history from the past, but talking to two people who have been actively involved in the movement. Nelson Linder has been president of Austin NAACP, I believe now for, was it 20 years now, Nelson?
20 years, yes, sir.
20 years. And when I met Reginald Owens, he was managing editor of the Houston Informer newspaper when I met him back in 1985. And at that time, it was the oldest black newspaper west of the Mississippi. Am I right, Reginald?
That's correct. That's correct.
And at one point, it was the third oldest newspaper in the country. Unfortunately, it is no longer in business. But I thought it was important. I'm going to go ahead and start off with Nelson, because when I met Nelson, I met him when I was the co-host of the Wake Up Call on KZI 88.7 FM. He was part of an organization. I was at Washington Garvey Turner or Washington Garvey.
Garvey Washington Allen Project.
Garvey Washington Allen Project. But even more important than that, there was an incident, not even an incident. A young black woman was killed in 2001, Sophia King. Mm-hmm. And Nelson Linder, I will never forget, standing out protesting, him and his vice president Barry, by themselves, solely, day after day after day, against the unjust killing of Sophia King. So Nelson, I want you to start off talking about what had happened back then and the beginning of your critique and evaluation of the Austin Police Department.
Well, when I became branch president in 2000, I was given a list of concerns that needed to be addressed. One was the shooting of black people in this city and the disproportionality of them being killed all over the place. But yet, there was no really comprehensive response. So when I became branch president, things happened right away. We had our first oversight office at the time on Iris Jones, and we had the shooting of Sophia King. And that galvanized a lot of things. So when I looked at the King killing, there were previous killings that the same thing, except they never got the kind of attention. We had to do something to get people in the city aware of the police shooting of black people. And so we started a protest, myself, Barry Hall, and some other folks as well. We had to go downtown in front of the police office at 7th Street, 8th Street, but also the DA's office. We did both. For 1 year. And although we were by ourselves making a point, people paid attention. And for 1 year, we met a lot of people all over the city, not just downtown. We actually went to Mopike and 360. Can you imagine black people at Mopike and 360 in 2000? And one occasion, there were folks who threw bottles at us, but thank God we ducked. And I remember downtown at police office station where Crazy Evans was attacked the first day by a Caucasian lady. But because we were disciplined, we didn't respond. She yelled and screamed. We didn't break rank, and guess what? Things continued. So that taught me right away the work we had to do. And at the time, there was a lot of fear because folks here were afraid of police. They were afraid of political involvement because of their jobs and other things. So we had a lot to work on. But we were planting a seed saying, look, we can stop these issues by getting involved. But first of all, educating people and knowing what strategies to use. We had our first database in 2000 that showed the history of Black Austin and police issues. That was important. So we had to lay a foundation so we could build a framework for addressing these issues. And that's my short story on how it affected me and how we got involved.
Well, before I go to Reginald real quick, I do want you to talk about the late, great Captain Louis White. He was the first Black police captain. He was part of the NAACP, and he really helped the NAACP to understand the Austin Police Department.
You know, I want to go back to Professor Peniel Joseph about the complexity of who we are. Now think about this. Captain White was also a union guy, but he was black. And being black, he saw the issues of civil rights. He worked from the inside out and made sure folks understood that black police officers had to be respected and have benefits. but also he reached out to us, the civil rights workers. So wait a minute, you got to have a balance here. On the one hand, we're going to help you understand what we're doing, hold us accountable. On the other hand, if you're wrong, we're going to tell you. So Captain Louis White was an example for everybody. He also worked with the Black Citizen Task Force, a man of just principle. No matter what he did, he always tried to be right. And it's really kind of a shame that today in Austin, most folks don't even know Captain Louis White. We honor him every Juneteenth. But he's an example of what Black police officers can do when they're conscious of the struggle and how they can play, kind of wear both hats. On the one hand, do your job. On the second hand, prevent police brutality. And his story needs to be read more often so you can understand we are multidimensional people, not just one-dimensional. And we can never grasp that. We don't have to attack the sort of unions overall because a lot of our people are there and they keep things in check. On the other hand, things that are wrong, like funding, we can address that. But Captain White was probably one of the most courageous person I met in my life. He wasn't afraid of anything at a time when you had no protection. So he's definitely a legend in this city. And we're going to work very hard to make sure folks know who he was and his influence on me and, of course, Austin and NAACP and elsewhere department.
Now, Reginald, you did your dissertation on a study of Black newspapers and the startup and how they became very much part of the movement. And so talk a little bit about how from the very beginning, Black newspapers were actually part and parcel of the fight for Black people to gain their rights and justice in this country.
First of all, I'd like to pay homage to my friend Akwesi Evans, the late Akwesi Evans. And he's a perfect example of how Black newspapers and community movements can meld together to make change. And I just wanted to mention that. And that's really what his newspaper was all about. That's how I ended up meeting Nelson Linder 30-some years ago. And because of Akwesi's concern for the community, and that throws back to the historical roots of the Black newspaper. In its basic form, the first Black newspaper, Freedom's Journal, was founded to express to the people of New York City their disgust with how a local newspaper was portraying them in the media. And when the Blackest people of New York City in 1827, when they went to this publisher to ask for them to rebuttal some of these things that were being put in the newspaper. And by the way, these are free Black people. This is like in the 1820s. These are free Black people and maybe a few slaves up in that part of the country. And this publisher refused to, he said, you know, Black people are not gonna put anything in my newspaper, and very adamant about it. So they went and they said, well, we'll start our own newspaper, which they did. John Rushworm and Samuel Cornish started the newspaper. It was a reaction to people's view of them in the mainstream media. Also, it was set up to protest and to appeal for the abolition of slavery. Those are some of the surface views that we have. But beneath all of that was, if we look at the period from 1827 on to the 20th century, we look at that period. That period was one where the Black newspaper, in my view, and in the views of other historians, the Black newspaper helped to set up what we now call a Black consciousness, because we didn't have we were in so many disparate places, and what the Black newspaper did was to put to give some meaning to what we now call a Black consciousness. Now, the issue that started this was, even among the white abolitionists, they wanted to They were for the abolition of slavery, but after the slaves were free, they wanted to send them someplace else. And the black people in the movement said, no, we work for this. We worked in this country. This is our country. We're not going anyplace else. So that became a big issue during that period. And that was the issue that black intellectuals coalesced around, and they advocated it through their publications. So the black newspaper, it's like everything, it's like the black newspaper and the civil rights movement, the black newspaper and the movement for black freedom. Every movement must have a communication component. And one of the things in my studies on black communication, one of the things I look at is I look at the total communication environment of blacks. And we're talking about newspapers, we're talking about interpersonal, we're talking about music, we're talking about churches. So all of these things work in concert for the total goal of black freedom.
So I do want to throw in a couple of musical references here where you talked about music also playing a role. I don't know how many people remember the song by Freda Payne, Bring the Boys Home.
Oh, yes. Oh,
which
yes.
was a protest song against the Vietnam War. And then, of course, we have the Marvin Gaye album, What's Going On, which was a complete protest album. Makes me want to holler, throw up both of my hands. We got the Temptations, Ball of Confusion. And so there's a lot of music that has played a role in the protest movement. I could also go into Public Enemy. But Dr. Owens, I do want to add another question here. So you worked with the People United Against Police Brutality, who marched and demonstrated for the creation of a police review board in the early 1980s. So talk about your role in helping to communicate and get support in the broader Houston community for what they were trying to accomplish.
Well, in that movement, I was basically, this was a movement that came out of Shape Center in Houston, and it was led by Deloitte Parker and Ernest McMillan. And it's really interesting. I look at what's happening now in terms of the kinds of things that the establishment is willing to give up and willing to concede to. Something as simple as a police review board back in the early 1980s, that was such a they wouldn't have anything to do with it. And so now it's just amazing to me how we have come full circle in terms of dealing with those issues. And basically in that movement, I served as sort of the PR person. I served as the PR person in terms of making sure news got out to the newspapers. And one of the things that we look at in that movement and in many other movements is that the black newspaper somewhat served as an early warning system for a lot of issues in the broader community, because the mainstream media would not cover them, or did not cover them, or wouldn't cover them, until the black newspaper aroused the communities, the black community, and then the white newspaper would monitor our newspaper to see what we were publishing, and then that's when they would get on an issue. And that's mainly been the traditional role of the black newspaper. But it's interesting as we come now with the advent of social media. So social media is beginning to take over that role that was exclusively for the black newspaper. And we are kind of in flux right now in terms of that ironclad rule, or that ironclad role rather, that the black newspaper traditionally had. And it's not just with the black newspaper, with the advent of social media, the whole newspaper industry, the whole mass media industry is in flux in terms of people trying to find their niches and people and the owners trying to find a revenue stream that they can rely on.
Well, I think it's important to note that, and it was touched on a little bit in terms of the financial contributions of John Hervey Whelan, how he helped to raise money for the activists in North Carolina. Dr. Martin Luther King spent a lot of time raising money to get people out of jail, to fund the movement. The movement takes money. Nelson, talk a little bit about the Austin and the movement takes money. Nelson.
Well, let me give a little full disclosure here. I was born in Central Georgia in 1958. And that's much of my background as where I learned because it was real time. So I didn't, this is not theoretical for me. We fought on the street wherever we were and learned some very valuable lessons. Going to Austin, Texas, I'm an insurance agent. And I can share this with you. If I was not independent in the little income I make, I could do the work that I do. So the financial part is so critical to our community. And so when you talk about things like capitalism, let's not get caught up in the ideology, because a lot of folks like me and others who make a little money can also contribute to our own cause. And so nobody to me is locked in a box. So when I look at my people overall, the financial piece is very important, because without money, without savings, without life insurance, you can't really build a community. So I think it's very important for folks not to be blinded by an ideology, but be able to expand what you see. Because it's multidimensional. And having said that, that's why I talked about Booker T. Washington. Whether you like it or not, at a very pivotal time, he talked about how to build institutions financially. Beyond his politics, he talked about having this skill in a society where you can make some money. And those questions are still relevant today. Now, I'm not a Booker T. Washington prophet. I pick and I choose. And I will say with any leader, given your previous guests, when I see our whole movement, I'm looking at what works, what doesn't work. What have we learned from Macklin and Martin? Because those are critical questions. All those guys have strengths and weaknesses. I'll say if we embrace the best of our practices, we can do better on the battlefield today. I call it a battlefield because it is a battlefield. If you don't learn your lessons, guess what? You can't win this battle. One of my concerns is hoping that in the day, in 2020, we're talking about buying black steel. And if your consciousness is right, guess what? You do it automatically. So there's much work to be done about what we do and how we do it, but it's got to be inside here. It can't be a slogan. It can't be rhetoric. You got to embrace it, understand it, and you got to live it. And that's kind of where I am today.
Let me add quickly on Booker T. Washington. The image is that he was co-opted completely by the white community. The reality was, undercover, he was funding cases to fight racial segregation while publicly supporting it. That's, and I'm going to ask both of you to comment on that. So Booker T wasn't just, the image is just doesn't really relate to how complex he attacked the movement with, because he was very critical of W.E.B. Du Bois at times and other leaders, but at the same time, he was working undercover in a manner that nobody really knew about until it came out later. And I'll start with you, Nelson, and then go over to Reginald to comment on that.
Excellent point. I think in the book Black Power, here's what Stoker Carmichael said. On the battlefield, you need to have tactics, not principles. Because principles don't change. Washington had a certain tactic. He knew in order to be practical, he had to make certain compromises. He did that. But also, look at Tuskegee. He's a perfect example. If you can only deal with one ideology, you can't be successful. On the other hand, you got to employ different tactics in different situations to get things done. You're not losing your credibility by doing that. It's called survival. We need to have that more today. You can't just be in one corner of the struggle. You got to make sure you can talk to everybody. Don't sell yourself out. But there are lessons to learn. When you learn those lessons, you can be effective. Because at some point, we need the Booker T. Washington. We need his ideas. We need our institutions. And sometimes you can't look at a person's faults and make a decision. Look at the entire person and what he was dealing with. And I would say overall, given his challenges, he did a pretty good job. And I hope today we learn those challenges and also those strategies. Remember that tactics can get you through a lot of different situations. Never show your full hand. Show what's available at the time and what's needed. That's kind of how I see this whole conversation, really.
And Reginald,
lessons learned and putting those best practices where we are.
And Reginald, could you also comment, Reginald, on Ida Barnett Wells, because she was a newspaper publisher also, Reginald, as well as fighting lynching.
In Memphis, and she later had to move to Chicago because they burned her press down in Memphis. She was a brilliant and gallant fighter against lynchings. And she's from Holly Springs, Mississippi, which is not too far from Memphis. And she basically led the fight to get laws to combat lynching. And she eventually ended up moving to Chicago, where that's where she ended up. And she was writing for the Defender up there in the early part of the last century. But let me get back to when you start talking about, you were talking about Booker T. Washington and the different roles that he had to play. What a lot of people don't understand is that Black people in the South in leadership positions, they had a real tight rope to walk in terms not getting the white people on their bad side, because that's in terms of Tuskegee, and as you know, I'm from Grambling, and in terms of Grambling, you have to keep the white people on your side in order to get the correct funding or any funding for the university. And so the Black leaders, and Booker T. Washington was a perfect example, and we can probably go to almost any Black institution in the South. They really had a fine line to walk in terms of trying to keep Black people calm and also trying not to upset white people. And in the process of all of that, many Black leaders ended up, you know, getting the label of Uncle Tom. And some were actually really Uncle Toms, but a lot of it was a role that they had to play. And when we start talking about the newspaper, the one thing that I didn't mention the last time, we start talking about the Black newspaper, I'm looking at the Houston Informer. Back in the late 40s, the publisher of the Houston Informer, Carter Wesley, who was also a lawyer, by the way, he was behind the strategy to get a lawsuit against the University of Texas to admit Heman Sweat. And Heman Sweat was a carrier for the Informer, and he was also a mailman in Houston. And because of the efforts of Carter Wesley and the NAACP, of which he was a member there in Houston, they worked with the NAACP through Thurgood Marshall to get this lawsuit against the University of Texas to admit Heman Sweat. And in the process of trying to fight that, the Texas State Legislature put in the mechanism to form Texas Southern University. At the time, they called it Texas State University for Negroes. So that also said that it should have a law school and a journalism program. And they specifically named some things that were supposed to go into that. So that was the role the Informer played in that particular thing. We look at, for instance, when we're talking about World War II, one of the things that Black newspapers have had to again fight this fine line we gotta always walk, criticizing the government. A lot of newspapers have gotten on the wrong side of the white establishment for criticizing the government. And that's where in the 40s, Robert L. Vann of the Pittsburgh Courier came up with the slogan, double V. In other words, we're going to have victory overseas against the Nazis, and we're going to have victory at home against the segregation and other things against black people. And so this is how the black newspaper, and by the way, this Double V campaign became nationwide through the National Newspaper Publishers Association, which is the advocate group for black newspapers here in the United States. So, you know, these are the kinds of things that the black newspaper's done. And believe me, it's been done in concert. You know, it wasn't no serendipitous kind of thing. They deliberately got together to do these things. And like I said earlier, in any endeavor, you've got to have a communication component. And in the case of African Americans, the black newspaper was it historically. And it's being subsumed now by social media.
That's a whole nother session.
Yes.
We still have Tommy Wyatt here in Austin, Texas. And I do miss the late Akwesi Evans. And thank you, Reginald, for paying homage to him. I've known Akwesi since the 1980s and did such an incredible job with NCOA. And wasn't that bad of a chess player either, by the way. But Nelson, what is your assessment of where we are today? So you've been involved as a civil rights leader and activist in Austin prior to becoming president of the Austin NAACP. You've been working to try to help reform, and that's my word, not yours. You may have a different word, the Austin Police Department, since you've been president of the NAACP. So what is your assessment of where we are today and what we need to do to move forward? Because you've educated me. I won't reveal all my misunderstandings that you helped me to better understand. So if you could talk a little bit about where we are today, and for example, my misconception that the big issue was the unions, and you helped me to get a better understanding of that. So talk a little bit about maybe some of the misunderstandings people like me had about what we need to move forward.
Well, let me just say this about the unions. You know, prior to 2014, we had a seven-member council, an at-large political system. And during that period of time, the unions had a lot of power. They pretty much financed most of the candidates, and they were very, very difficult. But even under that situation, we fought many battles and won those battles in that system. But in 2014, we moved to a 10-1 system, which meant that the money was decentralized. So all of a sudden, you got people like Greg Kazar and others who were elected independently, and they could fight the unions. So I always remind people, union weren't the issue. The issue was your city government. And when you change your government, guess what? You take the power from one organization. But what I see today is I look at this entire movement, and here's kind of what I see. We talk about historical moments. When there's historical moments and everybody's paying attention, you can kind of walk in the door because now all of a sudden it's fairly safe. I reminded people during my conversation last week that during the Kerner Commission's report in 68, you know, in Detroit, Michigan, in one night, something like 46 people got killed overall. I mean, we were being shot and killed all over the country. Think about what happened in the 60s. They had very little protections. But today, with social media, with the awareness, we had some casualties, but for the most part, we had cell phone technology, and a lot of that stuff was basically halted. So today, it's a whole different environment. And I always remind young people, you didn't just get here. You got here on the shoulders of other people because it's been a successful fight in each generation. They always ask me, Nelson, are we the greatest generation? I said, no. The one that preceded you was the greatest generation because they brought you behind here. They said, what do you mean? Well, because we're all doing the same thing. So when you start talking about what generation did it, that's a source of conflict. No, every generation played a Bible role based on what they were. So today, we have an enormous opportunity. But here's my fear and I think my challenge. As Brother Owens mentioned, the black newspaper played a critical role. You had to read. They did real-time work. And that earned you something. Oftentimes in social media, things are happening too fast. And oftentimes there is always a chance of mistakes and misunderstandings because it's just like this. So you have to appreciate the struggle. So today, while the doors are open, there are a lot of folks that are out there that are doing things, they don't understand the basis of why they're there. Now, this is a moment. It's not going to last. So the question is, where do we go from here? We hope, number one, there's been some changes already, some small changes. But the real changes, as King said, is going to lie ahead. You're going to have to transform and rebuild these institutions. And to do that, you need to have a knowledge set, a skill set, and an idea of where you're going. So in Austin, Texas, we like to tell people, we just start with the death of Mike Brown. We've been fighting police issues since 2003. we had our first indictment here in Austin in 2004 with the Jesse Owens case. So we didn't need a historical moment. So when I see these protests, I'm reminding people, it started a long time ago. Thank God that everybody's involved. But remember that folks have been fighting this stuff for years. And our ancestors told us, we call it anecdotal information, what was going on. We didn't believe them, but they were right. It's not because you got a camera and a video, it'll make them wrong, you just have an advantage. So we have all this experience now, our history, our present, what do we do with it? The first thing is, understand, number one, that the struggle is being redefined. And our folks right now are working to push you in a certain direction. That's why the history is important. You got to stay focused. Remember what our goals were in terms of economic empowerment, cultural understanding of our people, staying together, not being divided, because I'm saying a lot of stuff now that scares the heck out of me. If you don't have your history and understanding of it all, you're going to get lost in the process. Today in Austin, I mean, we have our own challenges, obviously. Everybody does right now with policing, really. We got to do a lot of things differently. I don't say defund. I say, look, public safety has never been just the police department. We have to redefine public safety, mental health, social workers, our own institutions. That's what we've been saying for years. Put more money in our own institutions, in our own communities. Let me give you a quick example, and I'll stop. I was at a store on Sunday, around the corner, convenience store. There was a young brother in his car. He was outside asleep, and the car was running. I walk inside the store, and they're having a conversation about how to approach him. Interesting, right? And they saw me. They went, "Now, what do you think?" Well, I said, "Let's not call the police, first of all." So what they did was, apparently, the fire department pulled up first. Then came EMS, and the police were way in the background. The fire guys got out and approached the car, knocked on the door, and talked to the brother. You see how things can change things by just perceptions? So we need more EMS, more social workers, and more folks who can talk to people to defuse certain situations. That's something that we can embrace. So when that comes to the budget, don't put the money away. Put it in viable institutions that treat people as human beings. That means the police have to deal with that because they've done a poor job of dealing with these issues. So now we're in a very special moment. Our budgets, though, have to be allocated proportionally. We've been fighting budgets for 20 years, nothing new. So the money got to go to the right places. As Gil Scott would say, we all pay taxes. We have to understand that and make sure we watch the budget process and make sure that they invest in our communities. They're not giving us anything. We pay for it. I can't hear you, Hopton.
So, Reginald, I'd like you to close with your assessment of the role the media can play today. And when I say media, in a very broad sense, because as we've said, there's a social media, there's Facebook, there's Twitter, there's Instagram. So in your assessment as a lifetime journalist, what is the role you think the media can today play in contributing to the movement?
The first thing, and this is something that I preached for most of the time I've been in teaching and working in the media, we need to understand our community. We have to know the different areas of our community, and we have to have connections into those areas, because we can't serve as an early warning system or deal with issues in our community if we don't know about them. And to me, that would be the main thing that we have to do. And in terms of movements, movement leadership must understand how to coordinate all these different aspects of the media, because different media play different roles for different kinds of problems and different kinds of issues. So we need to understand how these things can be coordinated. Everything doesn't have to be advertised. Everything doesn't have to be put on social media. So in terms of what strategies and what the particular goals are you have for a particular movement, we need to understand that before and understand that and then understand which type of media would be best used for that. And that's a very general kind of a thing that I would think of and do in terms of the question you asked.
So I'm going to go ahead and read some of the comments here. We got Mark Cunningham, who talked about the role of Black newspapers, who made public the lynchings and the disappearances of Blacks as well. because otherwise they never would have been made public. And again, falling back on Trotter, the newspaper promoted the protests and helped organize the protests. They were everything. So I think we covered that a bit, Reginald, when we talked about Ida Burnett Wells. We talked about the importance of the media. Brandon, Dr. Winford talked about the Black press as being an undervalued aspect of the Black experience. And of course, being in the vanguard of upholding and pointing out the contradictions of American democracy and citizenship. And John Hervey Wheel and his bank financially supported the Black newspaper, the Carolina Times, in terms of advertising. So that was a comment we have from Dr. Winford. And we do have a question from Jamie Watson. And this is to Dr. Owens. After the protests and events that occurred after the death of George Floyd, Mayor Sylvester Turner of Houston formed a police reform task force that is supposed to have more power than the previously formed independent police oversight board. What would you suggest, given your involvement with the People United Against Police Brutality, needs to be done to give the task force some teeth? Dr. Owens.
I would say in any kind of situation like that, make it as independent as possible from the mechanisms of the police department and the city. So we don't have any political leaning on people in different sectors of the bureaucracy. That would be the main thing.
And I'm going to ask Dr. Joseph and Dr. Winford to go ahead and join us. You had another point?
Let me make one other point. Yeah. For those who don't, Jamie Watson is the daughter of a former publisher and owner of The Informer. And I worked with her at The Informer and also taught her at Texas Southern University. Just wanted to make that note.
Another comment from Mark Cunningham. He brings up The Breakfast Club, which is a show on KZI 88.7 FM. And when it was Tommy Wyatt, Akwesi Evans, and Reverend Frank Garrett Jr. I'm going to ask Nelson, as a host of the Wake Up Call, to comment on the importance of radio and your memories of The Breakfast Club with Tommy, Akwesi, and Reverend Frank Garrett Jr.
You know, there is no substitute for Black radio. It's the soul of Black people, historically, and even today. If you hear things like Urban View, it's the same thing. When we do things, has a certain amount of validity to it. The Breakfast Club with Frank Garrett, Crazy Evans, my friend, I mean, why? Those guys brought all their experience to the table. You were getting it real time based on what they experienced. You were getting real knowledge. And so it played a major role and keeping KZI and our community together. But also you had real-time debates. We didn't fake anything. You might hear some pretty powerful arguments, and that was necessary. But that program, to me, was in many ways the foundation of KZI. And it kept our people tuned in who wanted to hear what Black people were thinking. Now, today in America, we're kind of challenged with that because a lot of Black radio is gone now, except on the satellite. So KZI today, even with that format today, they still play a very viable role and holding things together. But Frank Garrett, Tommy Watt, newspaper, Black Press again, Crazy Evans, they were the foundation of much of what we're doing today. And I always remember that. I tell young people, go back and hear old takes about Frank Garrett and how he did his show. And Crazy Evans, read his paper in the core, think of what he wrote about and talked about. And Tommy Watt, of course, is an institution in Austin, Texas. He should be required reading and required study.
Well, one of the interesting things I do want to talk about is how there doesn't seem to be a broad knowledge of the most recent civil rights leaders in Austin, for example. We talked about Captain Louis Wright. So I would love also to hear from the historians here. So I'm going to ask Dr. Joseph and Dr. Winford to join this discussion, which is the importance of recognizing the leaders of today, because they are the ones that people like Dr. Joseph and Dr. Winford will be writing books about in the future. So I'm going to actually go over to Dr. Winford and then to Dr. Joseph to start that discussion.
think that's extremely important and really important in this conversation. If you look at Mr. Linder and his years of experience in sustaining the NAACP there, it's important for us to look around at those local leaders. And those local leaders come in many forms. The president of the NAACP, someone who is sustaining an economic development project and funding, someone who's funding scholarships in the community, someone who is mentoring kids in the community. So it's important to sort of understand the local context in terms of leadership, understanding the political structure of one's own community, right? Going and attending local county commissioners meetings, board of education meetings, really to understand also the public policies that are being implemented and discussed in these forums, because those are the kinds of issues or those are the kinds of systems of power that are going to be involved in implementing and leading the way in the future. And it can be backwards or forwards, but I think those things are important for us to sort of understand in this context and to also sort of think about our own role to play as our own role to play in leadership.
Sorry, what'd you say again? Okay, you can go ahead and get started.
All right, I do think someone, I think one of our people need to mute themselves. Go ahead, if you could go ahead and continue, Dr. Winford.
That's all I wanted to say, to think about sort of the local context of and who we're sort of identifying as leaders. Sometimes we can look at this, you know, the sort of one person or the sort of charismatic figure in our communities, but we oftentimes neglect those women who are organizing in various spaces, teachers and other folk. And we think about now the healthcare context, people who are already sort of involved in mental health education, the idea of integrative healthcare, where you have a doctor, you have a social worker on staff, bringing their experiences into the community, but also their understanding of public policy and how it sort of trickles down into those spaces.
Dr. Joseph?
Yeah, no, I think this is critically important, especially in Austin. I've been here for 5 years, and I've been an activist my whole life, including on marches with people like Reverend Al Sharpton in New York City before he had the MSNBC show when he's, you know, was just a grassroots activist doing really incredible work in New York City against police brutality. People like Sonny Carson in New York City, Jeetu Wayusi, Reverend Herbert Dowertry. You know, those are the people who I came up around. Sonia Sanchez by the time I got to Philadelphia. So what we need to do, I think, in Austin, because these movements, part of studying these movements, but also being active in these movements, is these movements get a kind of competitiveness, right? There's a kind of, because everybody, you know, wants to do good, but people want spotlight. They want to amplify their voices. Even those who are interested in Dr. King's notion of service-oriented leadership, like myself. So what we need to do in Austin is get together. I mean, I know Nelson somewhat, but more so where you're getting together collaboratively, you know. And for those of us who are in higher ed and we have that as a platform, but at the same time, we've always been active. So we didn't discover being Black by Spike Lee, like in my case. You see what I'm saying? So there's no person, there's no t-shirt that I discovered, oh my God, that I'm Black. So I was raised by Jermaine Joseph, Haitian activist, radical feminist, right? So I got a different education. So I've been studying Black feminism for 30 years because my mother, even before I started to formally study under Sonia Sanchez, was teaching me about gender equity in the house, in a couple of different languages, right? So she walks the talk, 81 years young right now. And so I think what we need to do is, one, get these voices so we can amplify these voices, but also understand it's a generational conversation. So you have Nelson, you've got Dr. Owens, you've got all these people like yourself, Hopeton, but there's younger people too. And some of them we all know, like Virginia Cumberbatch. We know the folks with the Austin Justice Coalition, but we have to get those voices together so we can have the history. But for those of us who've been struggling, we also have to admit, and I always admit this, is that our movements, whether it's Malcolm or Martin or Ella Baker or all of us here, for Black dignity and citizenship,
we have not been victorious. We have to admit that. You know, part of it is we've done great work. People have done great work. You know, Nelson Lindor doing 1- and 2-person pickets in 2000 is extraordinary work, you know, and I think that that should be credited. But sometimes we tell young people things were so worse back in the day, but it's just not true. It's their relative experience. It's just not true. And I can give people the data from racial slavery to the present, where we only had 4 million people in 1865, about 500,000 were free, including 276,000 were free in the South, and less than the 236,000 who were free in the North. And then look at the relative deprivation we face now with 42, 44 million people. We are in a worse condition now for many of us than then. And that's why black civil rights leaders were being booed in Ferguson, because you had some heavyweights, including people I admire, telling them, hey, it used to be worse. But we were looking at teenagers, and we've got those kids in Austin here too, who were missing teeth. They were missing teeth, and people were trying to tell them, and they were missing teeth because of a lack of dental care, everybody. All of us who are privileged to send our kids, we have dental care, we have health care. There's a bunch of black people in the United States who have no teeth. They're teenagers, they're 18, they're 19, they're 15, and they're missing teeth. They've never visited a dentist in their life. And it's not just the Mississippi Delta. It's New York City, where I'm from. It's Oakland, it's Los Angeles, every single city. So we have to tell people the truth. Right. So we didn't win black dignity and citizenship, even though you say Beyonce and Jay-Z, they won. Right. And there might be some other people who won. We have islands and archipelagos of prosperity, but we lost. We were defeated, but we continue to struggle. We continue to struggle. So we have to say that in Austin, too. Gentrification has defeated large parts of the East Side. Those black people shouldn't have had to move out. We should have had enough political power where we made the city council and the mayor say, these people are gonna be part of this community. They're gonna be part of these good schools. And when we get white investment and white people, the black people stay too. But we didn't do it, because even those of us who did, like Nelson and others, we lost. We lost. So what we're trying to do is build a movement where what? We can win. We can finally win. And that movement is, everybody here, you've heard about Black Lives Matter. They've got a movement. They've got a movement for Black lives, a policy agenda, reparations, defund the police, prison abolition, no cash, money bail, all those things, a universal basic income, which is Dr. King's idea, not Andy Yang in Silicon Valley. We need all those things. So we have to have audacious freedom dreams. We have to understand our national, but also our local history. We have to have the thought leaders, the women and men who've been leading us, but also in conversation with multiple new generations. And then we can strategize, have those tactics, right? Have those principles, have that service-oriented leadership. Because I agree with Nelson, this time is not going to last. This time is not going to last. We have the biggest political mobilization we've ever seen in American history. Post-pandemic, we're going to have some time to get together. We have to rally around things like Juneteenth. I agree with everybody here, and I've been listening to the whole conversation, and the idea of raising money. We have to raise money. Movements live on money. But we have to be ethical in how we get that money, right? And that's my disagreement with Booker T. Washington, because I heard everything everybody said, and he was an institution builder. But part of why the Tuskegee syphilis experiment happened at Tuskegee was because of some of those ethical compromises that Booker T. Washington made. So raising money is not bad, but we can't raise money from people who we know don't respect our humanity. We can't do that, right? So the Koch brothers, I'm not gonna take money from the Koch brothers, because I know what they've done through the American Legislative Exchange Council, right? So even if the Koch brothers are offering millions, not gonna do it, because it's unethical, it's unprincipled. So we have to tell the truth. We have to tell the truth. And right here in Austin, we have to get together with this leadership and really share that story, that generational story of all these people who've done such great stuff. One of the great books is about the desegregation of UT, Desegregating the 40 Acres is this awesome book, besides the book that Virginia Cumberbatch edited about the precursors as well. So we need to teach that history. I'm organizing a civil rights in Burnt Orange class. We're gonna be teaching the history of civil rights right here in Austin and at the University of Texas. And certainly I want voices like Nelson and others to be a part of that, who are sharing their experiences right here in Austin, leading that fight.
Wow. So Nelson and Reginald, love to hear your feedback on that passionate discourse by Dr. Joseph, because it's always great to have academics who are also activists, who are part of the movement and just don't comment on the movement. So I'd love to hear from you, Nelson, and you, Reginald, and your feedback on that. I can't hear you, Nelson. You need to unmute, Nelson.
No, I'm okay. Okay, here's what I'll say about that. I use a lot of battlefield analogies. We never lost a war. We lost some battles. And I want to speak about gentrification. We noted in the early 80s a decline in black population east of I-35. But keep in mind, we were 13% of Austin's population, black folks. And we had a 7-member city council where white folks picked one brown, one Hispanic. That's a hell of a fight. But yet, we're still on the battlefield pushing things forward. It took 50 years for us to get a 10-1 system. So I always remind people, this is a sustained war. Now, right now, we have a moment of opportunity. But don't forget that like any sustained war, you have moments of victories and moments of loss. That way you can go forward. But we've never lost a war because we're fighting, I believe, for the right cause. And our lessons have taught us that as a people, when we work together, we are one powerful force. So I believe everything you go through, in many ways, is just a lesson learned. If you learn those lessons, you can make this thing a lot shorter rather than longer. So what I'm saying is, at 61, I feel great. I'm still on the battlefield. And I'm trying to teach younger people some lessons that I've learned about strategies and tactics, about political power, about building your own institutions. That's kind of my goal right now. And I thank God for the health I have. But I need about 20 more years where I can teach folks how to run their businesses, where they can really buy black, create black. It's not a slogan. It's a cultural thing, because without a unified culture, you ain't never have no black institutions. Let's get that clear. It comes out of your culture. So the things that Professor Joseph talks about, we got to work those things out. But I will say this in closing. That's why I talk about this generational thing. Each generation had a specific purpose. That's kind of how I see it. I don't think God picked anybody to be better than anybody else. We all had a role to play. Now, some of us didn't do as well as others, but there are factors to that. But in the final analysis, we all played a role. If you see it like that, you're not competing. You're cooperating because you have a destination.
Reginald?
I think that the biggest thing that we need to understand is what contribution do we personally have to make to whatever the movement is at the time. Because we all do different things. Some of us do them very well, and some of us not so well. And so we need to find out what those things are that we can contribute. You know, we all can't be leaders. You know, we can't all lead, we can't all sing the solo. So we need to find out what particular thing we have to contribute to a movement. Now, another thing that I would look at is looking at the contributions of that others have made compared to the contributions that you make. One of the things, years ago, I wrote a poem called Colored Water. And it was inspired by a speech by an NAACP state president. I believe her name was Rupert Richardson.
Louisiana president of the NAACP.
Yeah. Right. And she talked about colored water, and I use this a lot. You know, these young people today didn't go through the things that Nelson and I went through back in the 60s and even the 70s. And one of the things that I do, I tell young people all the time, you need to drink some colored water to understand what it is that you need to do. Because a lot of, you know, I think one of the things that happens today with our young people, they don't know our history, and Dr. Joseph brought that up, and so did Nelson Linder. They don't know their history. And so the kinds of things that we went through are not the kinds of things that they went through. And that's probably why, you know, a lot of these kids are you know, there's some things that I remember. I used to talk to my young nephew when he was a teenager, and they lived in a mostly white neighborhood in Houston. And I told him, and I kept telling him, I said, look, you can't do what these little white boys do. You can't do the same kinds of things and be expected to be treated the same way. So understanding what our particular contributions are and understanding what our history is and the things that we need to be looking out for to protect ourselves and to advance ourselves.
Well, it is almost 12 p.m., and so I will go from left to right on my screen. Thank you, Dr. Reginald Owens, retired chairman of the journalism department at Louisiana Tech University. Thank you, Nelson Linder, Austin NAACP president for 20 years. Thank you, Dr. Peniel Joseph, who is the founding director of the University of Texas at Austin Center for Race and Democracy and a professor. Thank you, Dr. Brandon Winford, an assistant professor of history at the University of Tennessee. Also, Dr. Joseph and Dr. Winford, if you have a book handy and you want to put it up so that people are reminded of the books that you have written for Dr. Peniel Joseph, The Sword and the Shield, The Revolutionary Lives of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. For Dr. Go ahead, Dr. Branford, Dr. Winford.
John Herbie Wheeler, Black Banking and the Economic Struggle for Civil Rights, University President.
You want to hold this up?
I have. I have some others, Professor Joseph. So. Stokely Life, and then Wait Until the Midnight Hour.
So. Oh, Stokely, I think I know the author of that book. I think he might be at UT Austin.
All right.
I had to cover, man. So.
This is live, and I don't.
So this has been an incredible yes.
I'd like to give a shout out to Dr. Joseph from a mutual friend, Melvin Wade.
Tell Melvin. Melvin is great people. Tell him I said hi. That's great. He's wonderful.
All right. Person. When he found out I was on this panel and he saw you, he ran down your pedigree.
No, Melvin's one of the people who helped amplify that pedigree. Definitely.
And for those of you who don't know, Melvin was an instructor in the what is now the Warfield Center back in the 1980s. And he was a brilliant folklorist and a mentor of mine.
Yeah, thank you. One. Yes.
There we go. And I do want to remind everybody that KZI Book Review, my show that's been on the air since 2009, airs every Sunday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. and every Monday from 8 a.m. to 8:30 a.m. with interviews with authors of the latest in fiction and nonfiction. Those interviews are actually being put up as podcasts. I've been rolling them out a little bit at a time. So if you can't catch the show live, first and foremost, support your community radio station. KAZI is a 501c3 nonprofit organization started in part by the late, great Dr. John Warfield, from the University of Texas at Austin, one of the founders of KZI radio station to serve the Black community. When it was started back in 1982, there was no Black radio in Austin, Texas. It's a non-commercial radio station, 501c3. Please support KAZI. Thank you. Like I said, the work Dr. Orange you're doing, the work you're doing, Nelson, the work you're doing, Dr. Joseph, the work you're doing, Dr. Winford, is incredibly important work. And we will be back August the 8th with another edition of Diverse Literary Voices of Texas, well, where we will be featuring the work of unpublished authors. So thank you very much, everybody. Thank you, Austin Community College, Charlotte Gulick, the City of Austin, Cultural Arts Division of the Economic Development Department, HEB, Capital Metro, Velva Price, District Clerk. Thank you, everyone. And everyone have a great day.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.